reviewing the remodeling of the sanctuary. So there's no Bibles in front of me, so it'll be up on the screen. But it's in Matthew chapter 10, and there Jesus does this extraordinary thing. He who has to figure out God's plan has to decide, how am I going to spread this message throughout the world in this very potent kind of rural area that no one really pays any attention to? How am I going to start a world-changing message here? And what he does is he decides on a strategy to have disciples, followers, who follow him faithfully, and then out of that pull out 12 men. Again, back then, women would not have been able to be part of this. He calls out 12 men, who then he invests his life into for at least 2 years, maybe a little bit longer, maybe three. And he just gives them, they're with him all the time. They seek to understand him. And as we know, we get to the end of the gospel, they still don't really understand him. It takes a while for them to kind of get a foot. We've been in Acts. They're struggling with many of the concepts that Jesus taught. There's battles, there's issues. If you read the letter to the Galatians, it really highlights the battles that they have. What really is this new message, this gospel, which literally means good news? What is this good news really all about? And he decides, I'm going to have these 12 men who nobody in their right mind, and on by everything's standards, would choose to be his carriers of a message that's going to affect and change the entire world. He chooses people, just ordinary people, not scholars, not the most distinguished people. He chooses people from all over the range of life. And last week we talked about four lessons that we can learn just from reading this list of disciples and a little bit that we know beyond there. And I'm going to talk about four more today and just end this as a two-part kind of message. So on the screen, you'll see Matthew 10, chapter 1. Chapter 10, verse 1. So Jesus called his 12 disciples together. Now, up to now, he'd had a number of disciples following him. And out of that, seeing the people, seeing them respond, seeing their openness to his message and listening to the Spirit, he chooses 12, representing the 12 tribes of Israel. It's his way of saying very clearly to the people that by choosing 12, and only 12, that this is the new Israel. What I'm about to do is new. It's no longer the Old Testament. We're now entering the New Testament, a different period. So that 12 is very significant that he chooses 12. Called the 12 disciples together, he gave them authority to cast out evil spirits and to heal every kind of disease and illness. In other words, do the things that he was doing. Here are the names of the 12 apostles. So that's the only time Matthew uses that title. First, he says Simon, also called Peter. Then Andrew, Peter's brother. James, son of Zebedee. John, James's brother. Two sets of brothers. Philip, Bartholomew. Then Thomas, Matthew, the tax collector. James, son of Alphaeus. Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who later betrayed him. And last week, just in summary, I'll just share the four things that I thought, or some four lessons we can learn. But first of all, it's not about title. Matthew's actually very careful to call the apostles, to call the disciples throughout the gospel, except this one place. Matthew is very, very clear that Jesus is not about title, honor, position. That's not what he's trying for. That's not what we're supposed to try for. The disciples, the 12 apostles, the disciples are very well remembered for having arguments amongst themselves. Who's going to be the greatest? Who gets to sit with Jesus on his right hand, the place of honor in his kingdom? You know, who's going to get the most special place? And we kind of look at that and think how petty, how small, but that would have been the normal way of thinking for men back then. It was all about how do you gain honor? How do you stay away from shame? How do you gain honor? And that would have been a big issue in their lives. And they're wondering, who's going to have the most honor? And Jesus says, it's not about that. Matthew wants to make it very clear in his gospel. It's not about that. It's not about who's first or who's second. It's not about climbing to the top. It's about serving where you are. It's about being his follower wherever you are, wherever you're planted. Serve there. Don't strive for titles and prestige and power and honor. He says, you know, in fact, he says, humble yourselves. Humble yourselves like Jesus did when he took off his outer garments and put on a robe, a towel, and washed his disciples' feet. the lowest of the lowest of the servants, God. Mammon's not about titles. It's not about titles and power and prestige. The second thing I thought we could learn by looking at Simon Peter is kind of the first in many ways. Simon was the one chosen in a way to lead the church. He's the one who speaks out in Pentecost, and the Lord uses to bring the first mass conversion. He's the one given a lot of honor in the early church, and yet he's first in quality as well as in leadership. He's often the gospel court jester as much as he is the disciple spokesman. So Peter is first. He represents, I think, better than any disciple, the height of faith and the depths of failure and despair and confusion. And just how Peter is so like so many of us, maybe all of us, who just, we don't have it all together, and yet God chooses him anyway. Just an amazing, amazing story. I talked about divine mathematics, that Jesus seemed to love the number two. He seemed to love this kind of crazy sense of multiplication. He sent out the disciples in twos. He called two sets of brothers. He talks in the Old Testament, there's this kind of poetry about how one will defeat 1,000, but two will defeat 10,000. It's beyond what normal math, this funky kind of math that God has, that when we're together, we can do more than we can apart. A divided church, I've asked in the past, how many of you have been part of a divided church? A number of you raised your hand, and you know what it's like when there's division, how futile things are, how hard it is to get things done. As in a very united church, we could get things done so quickly and so effectively and so powerfully. And I went up right after that, the church had been split in so many different ways, and it was like you had to have meeting after meeting with people, bringing people together to reconcile and to find ways to, you know, talk to each other, because they really didn't like each other and they disagreed anyway. And it like takes 6 months just to get people to consider talking about them. When we're together, so many greater things can happen. And it talks about Matthew as well. I think Matthew is really an example of see what God can do. Only in the Gospel of Matthew is Matthew actually called the tax collector. That's how we know he's a tax collector. The other Gospels don't tell us that, but Matthew himself says, I was a tax collector. I was the lowest of the low. I was the type of person that everybody here would detest. Kind of maybe a corrupt IRS agent or something like that who's using you to get, you know, bribing you to get money for himself. You know, it's like even worse than that. And Matthew said, that's who I was. And I think he included that in there to say, see what God can make of even someone like me. Because I think he's saying to us, see what God can make of even someone like you. God is not restricted by our past, by our present, by our struggles, by our battles. God can use us in so many ways. So, let's move on. The next lesson and the verse I want to talk about, I want to talk about some people we don't really talk about that much. The disciples. Thomas. Now, Thomas is an interesting character. I call this where Jesus meets us where we are. Thomas really appears three times in the gospel. And the one story in the end of John, which is giving him kind of a bad rap, because when you think of Thomas, what do you usually think? What's the adjective you put in front of Thomas? Anybody? Doubting Thomas. It's even kind of a phrase in our culture to say, I don't be a doubting Thomas. It's just something we did. Thomas is the one who doubted. So here's a story that talks about this. In John 20, it says, one of the 12 disciples, Thomas, nicknamed the twin, was not with the others when Jesus came. So Jesus had appeared to the other 11, or to the 10, because Jesus is gone, but Thomas wasn't there. Whatever he was doing, he wasn't there. So they came and told him, they said, we've seen the Lord. Next one. Is it fine? Hopefully it's fine. There we go. Okay, next one. But he replied, I won't believe it unless I see the nail wound in his hands, put my fingers into them, and place my hand into the wound in his side. In other words, I don't care what you say, I don't mind. 8 days later, so about a week later, the disciples were together again, and this time Thomas was with them. So again, why he's there now, I don't know. The doors were locked, but suddenly as before, Jesus was standing among them. He disappears. Peace be with you, he said. And he said to Thomas, put your finger here and look at my hands. Put your hand into the wound into my side. Don't be faithless any longer. Believe. My Lord and my God, Thomas exclaimed. He's just astounded. Then Jesus told him, "You believe because you have seen me. Blessed are those who believe without seeing me." And so we get the term doubt of Thomas. That's always been known ever since his encounter with the resurrected Lord. I wonder, is that really fair? You see, those two other times when Thomas features in the Gospels, where in John 11:16 and John 14:5, you can look those up on yourself, on your own. But that fleshes out Thomas a little bit more. Because both times you get the picture of a man who's a little down-to-earth realist. He's just kind of a down-to-earth, realistic kind of guy. He needs evidence. He wants solid data. He will draw his own conclusions. Don't tell me what you think. I need data. I will draw my conclusions. I will do what I believe and I see, and I will draw conclusions from there. Now, does that sound like any group of people today? Now, I think Thomas is the apostle for the engineers and the scientists of our day. Because isn't that what engineers and scientists especially are, right? You look at data, you prove it, you analyze for an analyst today. I'm not meaning this in a bad way. I just think that Thomas is in there, especially to reach out. I think each of the disciples touches a different group of people. I think Thomas is for those people who just have it in them. I want to see it for myself. I need some proof. Please, just let me make up my own mind. Don't tell me your beliefs. Or you give me your belief system. I want to make up my own mind. And yet, with all of his brainy proof now attitude, it's Thomas, what we've come to call doubt. It's Thomas that Jesus decides to meet Thomas right where he is. I mean, if you look at verse 27 again, it says, "And Jesus said to Thomas, put your finger here and look at my hands. Put your hand into the wound in my side. Don't be faithless any longer. Believe." Okay, there's a mild rebuke in there. He's scolding him a bit. But there's no sarcasm. There's no disgust. There's no disdain. There's no, "You're not worthy of me, Thomas." Simply, "Thomas, come here and see for yourself. I know what's in your heart. I know you need data. You need to decide for yourself. Put it together for yourself. And so, Thomas, here I am. Do what you need. I am here." And reality finally dawns on this man that this impossible thing is very possible and very real. And so he utters what has become, in many ways, the classic, most brief, and one of the greatest confessions of faith ever spoken. I mean, people have commented and quoted this for centuries, since then, 2,000 years. "My Lord and my God." To fall down before Jesus and say, "My Lord and my God," that's enough. That's all he can say. He is in such awe. And yet Jesus concludes by issuing Thomas and all the rest of us a lesson. He says, "Blessed are those who believe without seeing me." But I don't want us to lose the truth in this story. That Jesus meets Thomas where he is. He doesn't just, brush him off. He meets him there. So Thomas is struggling with this fellow disciple's outrageous claim. And they wouldn't be outrageous, of course. This guy's risen from the dead. I saw him die. I mean, he was dead. He got out of the grave. He's risen. He's appeared to us. He needs to know for himself. And Jesus doesn't dismiss him. He doesn't ignore him. He steps right in front of Thomas and offers him with his heart and mind for coming out. And I want to say that to you, first of all, if you are here as someone who needs proof, that God, I believe, put Thomas in here for you. Because he's the one who needed proof like you do, and he's the one that God shows right here that God gave you. See, you have someone in here that your heart or your mind cries out for the same thing, and God answered that cry. He will answer your cry. And I want to encourage you who share your faith with others is don't be put off by other people's doubt or questions. Ask God to help them understand, to look beyond, to see things in new ways. Don't be put off by that. Because Thomas is an example, and maybe even show him his story. Say, "You know what? There was someone like you in the Bible. He needed it in front of his face, and Jesus was there to give it to him. I think he's there for you." What do you think that says to you? Jesus meets Thomas and us right where we are, wherever you are right now, there he is. Then I look at Andrew. Andrew's another one we don't really talk about. I mean, we know him mostly as who? Simon Peter's brother. And then when you think of the Simon Peter, maybe you think of Andrew as well. And I call this one bringing others, or bring others into Jesus' presence. As a lesson. Now, you never hear Andrew preaching or teaching. Apparently, he just wasn't a big preacher or teacher. But he single-handedly is responsible for two major miracles in the New Testament. Without Andrew, who knows what would have happened? The first was his brother, John 1. In verse 40, it says, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, was one of these men who heard what John said. So John the Baptist had said to a group of his followers, he had said, you know, you need to follow him. Don't follow me anymore, follow Jesus. He's the one God has sent. So Andrew hears that. And then he follows Jesus. And then right away, he went to find his brother Simon and told him, we found the Messiah. And Andrew brought Simon to Jesus. But he wasn't done, because later, there's another story with Andrew. There's a little matter a little bit later in John. It's half the world, so he's going to feed all these people. He's been teaching, he's getting pretty popular by now, and there's like 5,000 at least people. There's just 5,000 men, so we don't know if they're just being general, and there were more women and children as well, or it was just the men there, and we don't know. But there's 5,000 at least people. And Jesus finishes teaching, and they all sit down, and they just kind of hang around. They don't want to leave. Something big is happening. It's kind of like staying after a concert, staying after an exciting event. It's like, you don't want to leave. You want to be a part of it, you know. And they wouldn't move. They didn't move. And so Jesus looks at his disciples and says, feed them. I'm like, what? We don't have the money to feed these people. We don't have the money to feed these people. They're probably out in the countryside a bit. We don't have access to that kind of food. And Jesus just waits. And what happens is pretty amazing. A little boy with a lunch offers his lunch to the disciples. And here's what happens next. Then Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up. There's a young boy here with 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. He speaks up. You know, that man, that little boy, offered that bread and those fish to a bunch of disciples. But it's Andrew who has that vision. You know what? I don't know what this can do, but I'm going to bring this little boy to Jesus and let him decide what to do. Andrew was someone who brought people into Jesus' presence. And he said, you know what? That's all I need to do. I don't have to figure it out. I don't have to have all the answers. My job is just to bring these people into the presence of the Master of the universe. You know, we talk about Jesus and this boy. We talk about Jesus and Simon Peter a lot. But without Andrew, I don't know if either of those would have happened. Maybe so. Maybe God would have found another way, I'm sure. But Andrew was integral in that happening. Someone who saw a need in the willing heart and brought them together with Jesus. Now that's something we can all do. You know, you may not feel real comfortable sharing your faith. You may not feel real comfortable talking to people. You know, I know what that can be kind of scary. That can be kind of hard. Not all of us are really evangelistic. But you know what? Sometimes it's not what you have to do. Sometimes it's just bringing them to a place where they can encounter Jesus. Maybe you bring them along the Bible study. Maybe you invite them to church. Maybe you say, would you like to have lunch and get a couple of people together just to talk about it and see how it goes. Talk about spiritual matters. I remember when I was working in a stock room in Silicon Valley, way back when, a long time ago, when dinosaurs were on the earth. And I was just one of the guys pulling parts and giving to the shippers and, you know, and sending them out. And some of the people in the office, it was kind of very distinct difference between the people in the warehouse and the people in the office. You get, you know, they didn't really meet or get together. And some of the people in the office, I kind of was getting the wind that they were having some issues and problems. And they knew I was going on, I was headed on to seminary after that. And they knew that, and so they came to me and they said, you know what, can we talk to you about some spiritual things? I said, sure, fine. Can we just... They said, well, we don't want to do any formal thing. I said, well, why don't we just all bring our lunch one day and just sit down on the lawn outside and talk? And so we did. I started with 2 of us, and I got 3 and 4, and it kind of increased, you know. And so what ends up happening is that people start wrestling with things. And I didn't give a lot of answers. I asked a lot of questions. I let them talk amongst themselves and wrestle with it. And it actually led to people closer to the Lord. One lady who committed her life to the Lord, we'd fallen away. But it was just a real simple kind of thing. It wasn't a big deal. It was just very simple. Sometimes you just bring people to a place. So you can do that. You can share your faith, your testimony. You can bring a meal to a sick or grieving person. And that's a way of connecting them with Jesus' love. You can share an encouraging or comforting word. You can create a safe place for them to talk to you about things of faith, questions of faith. It might be anything. You know, I think, unfortunately, in today's day and age, and you probably know people like this, it's interesting. There are a lot of ex-church people who are no longer in church in our world today. And I'm sure you know people that used to belong in church, and they're not anymore. And it's interesting because I was in a church not that long ago, the last church I was pastor at, where it used to have 2,000 people, and it now there's maybe 300. And you find ex-Southfielders all over the valley attending other churches. But you also find a lot of ex-Southfielders not attending any church. And a lot of those are my friends, people I serve with, and alongside of some of them in leadership. And when I talk to them, and I do, and I say, why? What has happened? You know, I haven't yet met someone who is having a crisis of faith. They don't say, you know, because I was turned off to God. I don't believe in him anymore. I don't follow Jesus any longer. You know what they say? You can guess. I just can't stand being a church anymore. I can't stand the hypocrisy. I can't stand the fighting. I can't stand the politics. I can't stand how they treat one another. And I'm not saying that about this church. I love this church, and there's a lot of unity. There's a lot of heart. But in general, you know people like that. I mean, there's probably some of them are your friends or family members. They don't want to be a part of a group where Jesus said, by this, all men will know you are my disciples if you love one another. You know, we can bring people to Jesus, but we can also push them away from Jesus as well. And we're doing that a lot in the church today. Be something like an Andrew. Bring people into a place, at the very least, where they can encounter the living God. Whatever that means, ask him, Lord, what can I do? What can I do? The students have PCCC, which is awesome. To have that opportunity. But what can we do? All of us. Okay, two more. Simon, and I call this the power of Jesus to unite. Simon the Zealot. Next class on Matthew's list, he says, Simon, a member of the Zealot party. I've talked a bit about this group in a second, the Pharisees. The Zealots were the people who were just so totally outraged that Rome had come in and conquered them and was oppressing them and were so absolutely outraged that the collaborators. Sadducees and Herodians and all those collaborative tax collectors were the worst. So it's kind of ironic that he has Simon the Zealot and Matthew the tax collector, and it's like North and South Pole here. But it was very revolutionary, it was very anti-Roman, it was very aggressive. It would be like today some of the terrorists, it would be like Al-Qaeda. That's how Rome would consider the Zealots today. In fact, a zealot was as far removed from a tax collector as Osama bin Laden would be from George Bush. That's about the opposite of these two people would be. I mean, you can't imagine anything more opposite than that. And these two now find themselves in Jesus' special family, his special little group, only 12 people. You can't hide the distance and the disagreements and the fervor and the passion in 12 people. And yet Jesus brings them together into that. And just, I think that just shows the power of Jesus Christ to unite people. He's able to take people or groups at opposite ends and unite them to himself. Through himself, unite them to one another. And that's a real miracle. He actually helps us to unite to one another. There's so much division in our world today, in the Christian world today. There's division in churches, like I said, there's division amongst friends. If we disagree about something. Someone once said to me, I mean, it's a kind of famous quote. He said, this is our motto, the church I served a few churches back. He said, this will always be our motto, in essentials, unity, in non-essentials, liberty, and in all things, charity or love. In essentials, unity, in non-essentials, liberty, and in all things, love. And I thought that's a great attitude. You know, there's so much in our faith that we can use to push people away from us. push people away. Jesus says, I want to unite you. Do you know one of the most divided places on the planet Earth right now? It's called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It's a church that was built in the, on the site where Jesus supposedly was laid in the tomb. Where Jesus was laid in the tomb. That is one of the most divided places in the world. Because all these denominations have staked out a claim to part of that church. And so the Orthodox Church has this area, and the Catholic Church has this area, and all the way around. If you go there now, they'll have little services all by themselves in that area. And so when you go to your area. I was talking to a couple that just we visited Israel last year. And they said they went into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and it was like they walked in, and the Orthodox Church had just ended their service, and they were trying to get out, and they literally had people with sticks to beat people out of the way because they wouldn't move. I guess that happened before. And one of the people who was on the tour with them said, for the love of God, you're Christians. Where is your love? And they took the stick and just shoved them out of the way. Because they had to get out. In the tomb where Jesus was laid to rest. They said there's a ladder. If you look up, there's a ladder. Actually, there's a hole in the ladder going up in there. And the ladder's been there for 100 years. Someone repaired something 100 years ago, and the ladder's never been removed. And the reason it hasn't been removed is because that's a contested part of the church. No one individual group owns it. So no group allows anybody else to go up and get the ladder and pull it down because that would give them claim over that area. So no one has moved the ladder for 100 years because of their religion. That's not what Jesus is about. Jesus is the power to unite, not to divide. When you read Simon the Zealot, when you see Matthew the tax collector, realize they're in the same group. Osama bin Laden, Kurt Bush, and Jesus brought those two together, you realize that Jesus is awfully powerful. He can unite anybody. Don't give up. Be a source, be a person of reconciliation. Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall inherit the earth. And finally, Judas, what do you do with Judas? You know, there's so many things you can do with him. I just put, at the very least, I think Judas is a warning for us to be on guard, to be on our toes. He's the one who betrays Jesus, of course. His presence is disturbing, disquieting. He's one that Jesus called a traitor. But I think he's, at the very least, a warning that the Christian life is a dangerous life. It's not a safe life at all. You know, every Sunday since James has been leading us in worship, I'm sure you all know that he prays the Lord's Prayer a little different than the rest for the way we've been taught. We have been taught in the Presbyterian Church, lead us not into temptation and what? Deliver us from evil, right? How does James pray? Deliver us from the evil one, right? And that's because in the Greek, I'm not sure why he does it, but in the Greek, it's kind of ambiguous. And actually, it probably is closer to the way he actually phrases it. Because it has an article in front, so it's like the evil. But it's literally delivers from the evil. And in Greek, you would normally say the evil one. But somehow in there, in our history, that got thrown. It literally is saying, Lord, snatch us from the evil one. Snatch us from his power. Snatch us from what he wants to do in our lives. But think again of that Aurora shooting. You know, snatch us from going so far that we no longer connect with you. Keep on guard. The enemy is always seeking us to draw us away from our love, from our God, from our Savior, from our Lord. But also, God is so far greater. And he's always calling us to his side. Jesus gave Judas every chance. He gave him several chances. Even at the very end, he says, you don't have to do it. You don't have to do it. And Judas does it anyways. Judas, I think, is a warning to us. Be on guard. Be ready. Who knows what is going to come at you? But the enemy wants to pull you away. Anyway, So those are some lessons that I've learned. Maybe it gives you a chance to look into the apostles in new light. Then get into Thaddeus and Bartholomew and some of the others. You can do some of your own research. But there's just not much about them that we know. And yet we know that through their ministry and through the men that I've been talking about, God changed an entire world. We were sitting here 2,000 years later. Unbelievable miracle of miracles. Unbelievable. Because these men came together, united behind the truth of the gospel, and they brought people to Jesus. Lord, I thank you for the gift of these men. I thank you for choosing them, men like us, people that have failings and faults and struggles and battles and questions and doubts and fears, and Lord, even one who ran the other way and took you down, or at least he thought was. Lord God, you chose all of them and you gave them all an opportunity to serve and to honor and bless you. To be your hands, to be your feet, to be your mouth. So Lord, I pray that you would open our hearts to the same. Let us put your hands, your feet, your mouth. Let us do it together, united, Lord God, not divided. Bring us together, we